Hi there. This is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. It's Saturday, and it's looking great out today after we're here in Oakland and after two solid days of rain, which we desperately need in California. It's a sunny, beautiful day. We have a lot to cover today, and first I want to touch base on what's been going on with Facebook. We've had a couple of articles. One was the Hands in Stone, the panoramic trail in Kodachrome Basin State Park, Utah. I posted a number of photos. We had a huge reaction to those images. And as it turns out, those handprints could be the result of decades of rubbing. So the actual hands itself are the cause of the imagery, which is actually rubbed into sandstone. So I thought it might be Hanpacha style weathering, similar to what is found in Peru or the stonework. But actually, I've had a geology student actually say that he has seen it up front, and he believes that they don't actually describe it as hand rubbing, but it's appears to be, his estimation is that it actually is hand rubbing. So it is still quite a phenomenal effect, and there's a gigantic wall filled with these handprints that are actually embedded in the stone, pushed in the stone like the stone was in a state of like clay or a molten state, which would allow a hand. It looks like the hand's actually pressed into the stone, which is quite unique. So have a look at that. The other article that I want to mention is the Dwarka movie that's coming out in a couple of weeks. It's called Dwarka, Atlantis of the East, which is a movie put on by Amish Shaw, who is a producer. And it's a free program that will air, like I said, in 2 weeks, Thursday, May 1st, which is end of this coming week, which is, it's a Thursday. It's a free screening, and they have limited bandwidth, so you need to sign up fairly quickly to get onto that and see this the movie. It looks fantastic. Dwarka is estimated by some to be 30,000 years or older based on analysis of the artifacts that were brought up from the bottom of the ocean. So I'm not quite sure what the whole movie is about, but I believe it's a historical look at Dwarka and some of the questionable things that are going on in academic science. Apparently there's a lot of people that are not believing that, stating that they're not really making, you know, they're not really, the 30,000 year mark isn't really a possibility. So, but I think Graham Hancock has touched on Dwarka a couple of times, and he has had some remarks on it as being very, very, very old. So, as a reminder, we do appreciate call-ins. If you want to call in and speak to our guest, the phone number to call is 347-826-9565. That's 347-826-9565. So I am really honored to present our next guest, Robert Schock. Robert is a tenured faculty member at Boston University. He earned his doctorate degree in geology and geophysics at Yale University, and he's the author of Pyramid Quest, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, Voices of the Rocks, Stratigraphy, Environmental Science, and Parapsychology Revolution. Now, Robert's a quite unique individual. We've had John West on here before, and together, they really opened the eyes of the world when they were both looking and studying the Sphinx. And the traditional date was that Egyptologists gave to the Sphinx was 2500 or 2500 BC. But John West had been studying the works of another author and had felt that the weathering and the actual area where the Sphinx was, the Sphinx and the Sphinx enclosure, were much, much older. And so he sought out a geologist or someone who could prove it through analysis, and came upon Robert Schock. I mean, basically, their discovery rocked the scientific world, and a video was created, actually a TV documentary, The Mystery of the Sphinx, was created. And in this movie, we basically see that they show evidence, not just of visual evidence, but they actually present geological evidence. And the movie goes back and forth from the traditional point of view, with people like Dr. Lerner and other Egyptologists basically saying, this can't be right, this can't be right. And we go back and forth and back and forth. And at the very end, Robert Schock has this to say about his opposition. We're going to hear a cut from the movie. So just have a quick listen here.
Many archaeologists and Egyptologists have been highly resistant to my ideas. If my findings are in conflict with their theories, maybe it's time for them to reevaluate their theories about the rise of civilization. I'm not saying that the Sphinx was built by Atlanteans or people from Mars or extraterrestrials. I'm just following the science where it leads me, and that leads me to conclude that the Sphinx was built much earlier than previously thought.
Schock and I have a friendly debate going about the age of the Sphinx. Schock holds to his 5,000 to 7,000 BC date, mainly by taking the most conservative view allowed by the data to hand. I think, for a variety of both intuitive and scholarly reasons, that the date is much, much older. Schock isn't even in disagreement about this, but he prefers to take the most conservative view. I think that when and if our isotopic analysis and other areas that we're working in provide a date that, or provide data that we think is trustworthy, that date is going to be very, very old indeed. I think older than 10,000 BC, really older than 15,000 BC, and it wouldn't even surprise me if the date was a lot older than that. I really do believe that when we get a date, it's going to be something so staggering that nobody's going to believe the data.
So, Robert, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. It's, you know, strange hearing my voice from over 20 years ago.
I wanted to ask you if that brings up memories of that that whole filming.
Well, of course it does. Yeah, I mean, I was there.
Yeah.
I've been intimately involved with this for about 25 years now, and
wow.
That was shot in the very early 1990s. The film Mystery of the Sphinx was aired on NBC originally in 1993. And if I could put a quick plug in, because you mentioned a bunch of books, but you did not mention Forgotten Civilization, which is my latest book, which you've been reading.
I was actually going to highlight that and bring it up. But
That sounds good, ties in here because I review, as you know, but the reader, the listeners may not know, I review sort of the story of those early years in 1990 and then bring it up to present day. So, yeah, it's been a long journey, but a wonderful journey.
So one of the first questions I want to ask you, because you're, by the way, those who are listening, Forgotten Civilizations is Forgotten Civilizations, the role of solar outbursts in our past and future. It's one of the best books I've read, and I'm not even completely finished with it, but I strongly urge you to go out and get it, because Robert does an excellent job, not only bringing us back to when he started working on the Sphinx, but he takes us through a number of different ancient civilizations, and then the cataclysm that was reported, and it's just really well done. So kudos to you. But
I wanted to ask you,
one of the things that is I find quite interesting is the Egyptology community. And one of the first questions I want to ask you is, has anything changed in their opinion of your research?
That is sort of hard for me to answer, in the sense that I have not gotten sort of a solid confirmation, oh, yeah, you're right. But in a sense, it has changed, I would say. Many people, for instance, ask me, and they literally ask me, and they don't ask me as a joke, although it seems like a joke to me. With the further research over the last 20 years, we may get into this Göbekli Tepe, which is a site in southeastern Turkey, which goes back to the same period. And just as a comment, I am now comfortable with the oldest portions of the Sphinx being back to the end of the last ice age, about 10,000 BC. We can talk about that more. But all the information, all the data continues to confirm that the original Sphinx goes back to that earlier period, and I am finding over the last few years I'm getting less and less resistance, should we say, from Egyptologists. If pushed into a corner, they tend to still deny what I'm talking about, but I think it's harder and harder for them to do that. They are subtly acknowledging it by not talking about, not trying to confront me. They, for instance, now seem to agree. Again, they're not saying explicitly, but when you read their papers, they agree with me, for instance, that the head of the Sphinx, which is a dynastic head, is a recarved head. Egyptologists, for instance, are now discussing, well, when was it recarved? What was it originally? That type of thing. Again, you know, sort of skirting me because they don't, I think, you know, the politics and whatnot, they don't want to mention John West and myself directly, but they are adopting now a lot of the work that we first pointed out, and they're discussing these things seriously. So, you know, have they come out and said bluntly, oh, you are right, after all, we lay down and, you know, you
right.
win. They're not going to do that. I mean, they have too much pride and arrogance. But I do think we're making headway. And not to beat this into the ground, but for instance, I was very pleased to receive a pre-publication copy of a dissertation recently done at State University of New York, which is not a bad place at all. And this young fellow just got his PhD for a dissertation in which, among other things, he mentions my work on the Sphinx. Initially, when I received it, I thought, oh, no, you know, he's going to be criticizing it. No, he just talks about that this is now accepted, that the Sphinx is older. You know, and he's not an Egyptologist, but he's writing a PhD dissertation. So I think we're making headway.
Well, do you think it's going to take a multidisciplinary approach to investigating this phenomenon for the books to change? I mean, because there isn't any book or historical references in college texts, are there? Are there any changes in the college texts?
No, that's why I'm saying we're slowly making headway. There are, I do know, for instance, a reference in a geology text that talks about the Sphinx being older. Of course, it's based on geology. Really, what happens generally, and I hate to sound crude, but this is sort of a truism in academia, the old guard has to die off either figuratively in the sense that they retire or literally that they die. And then the new guard, the new generation, starts, working in a different paradigm. It's really a change of paradigm. And textbooks tend to be the last reflection of any changes, so textbooks tend to be incredibly conservative. I can point out to you many textbooks in many fields are basically behind the times.
Well, would you say you're encouraged by this paper this PhD student wrote?
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely encouraging, because what that's saying to me is the next generation coming up, they can look at this with fresh eyes. They can look at the actual data rather than have all their biases and presuppositions blinding them.
Well, this is interesting.
You know,
In your book, we're going to touch on the view of civilization in a minute here. But I guess my point is, this is a serious. You present serious ramifications for ancient history.
Exactly.
If we can date an ancient relic, the Sphinx, and perhaps some of the we know that the Sphinx in temple is also old, to 10,000 BC, this changes things significantly.
And I
am not an academic, but it's like, why would you continually teach that the Sphinx is 2,500 years old and was built or carved by, I think, is it Khafre? This is what the typical...
Khafre, you can pronounce it several different ways.
Right.
But, you know, part of the answer to that, I would say, is that academics are humans, and academics have feelings, and when I say that, I'm not trying to be sympathetic to them right now. I'm an academic. I live in an academic world. I've taught at Boston University for 30 years now, and so I know, you know, the academic world. And when someone has staked their career, say an Egyptologist, on a certain view, a certain paradigm, they have taught all their lives. They were taught, and they have always taught their students, that the Sphinx is 2500 BC. It fits into the fourth dynasty. They have a whole scenario of when it was built and why it was built. That is not easily questioned in their mind. And if it is questioned and someone questions it, they tend to react by digging in, supporting their position. Why, you know, it's sort of almost insulting to say that they've been wrong all along.
Yes.
You can talk about all you want that, oh, it should be science and it should be objective and we should go with the data. Well, first off, Egyptology tends not to be science, and I don't mean that in a nasty sense, but it's really not a science. It's more humanities. And when people's, you know, they have so much invested in it, it is them, their academic research, and to say that they've been mistaken all these years, that hits very hard home on a personal level, and they react. So I think a lot of it is psychological, if that's the right term, you know, people defending their turf. I've had Egyptologists tell me, you know, basically go away, you're a geologist, study rocks. I've literally had them tell me, study rocks somewhere else than in Egypt. You know, you're causing us trouble. They've literally said things like that to me more than once. They've said, we don't understand geology, which is clear to me that they don't, and we don't want to know about it. We know what we know, and we want you to basically go away and not cause trouble for us.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'd say it has nothing to do with truth and objective knowledge. It has to do with turf wars and them defending their positions at all costs.
So from what you've encountered, it doesn't seem that they're open to multidisciplinary science. Geology, or as you may be familiar with Christopher Dunn, who is an engineer.
Right. Sure, I know
who
him.
And he basically opened a whole Pandora's box when he revealed that a lot of the stonework cut on the pyramids and some of the other buildings was done by some form of power tools.
Right.
And it seems to me that the Egyptologists that I've spoken to either do not recognize him or think what he has presented is what they call it pseudoscience.
Right.
So
that's the easy way to dismiss things, is just to say it's pseudoscience, and then you can sort of wipe your hands and say, oh, I took care of that one, let's move on. But that's just name-calling. I mean,
right.
I have been called a pseudoscientist by the Egyptologists. I've been accused of, just wanting to get my, my picture, you know, be on television, and so I'm just making up things. I mean, they literally accused me of just making things up. Well, you can walk out there and you can see the rocks yourself. I'm not making this
up. I find it amazing, and of course you must have attended in the 20 years since that Mystery of the Sphinx came out. You must have attended a number of conferences that were
absolutely
either hosted by Egyptologists. But
yeah,
are you allowed to present? Do they invite you to present your findings now, or is it more cursory, kind of like, well?
I've presented at Egyptological conferences. Am I the most welcome person? Not necessarily, but yes, I have, mm-hmm. and I've gotten the reaction that I was describing, that basically they just want to look the other way. They want to ignore it. They tell me to go somewhere else and study rocks somewhere else, and they just don't want to be disturbed. But, and this gets back to the early part of our conversation a few minutes ago, I am finding that they are, to a certain extent, digesting and taking in what I'm saying, and then they're sort of reframing it to a certain extent. So I'll give you a specific example. The dogma had always been that the face of the Sphinx was the face of Khafre, Chephron, the builder of the second pyramid. I pointed out years ago now, in fact, it's in the original 1993 documentary, we talk about it, that this is not the original face, it's not the original head, it's been recarved. And Egyptologists, without ever acknowledging my comments, have been looking into that themselves. So one published a paper showing how, demonstrating that the head of the Sphinx is much too small for the body. Well, why would that be? Because it's been recarved. This is what I've been saying all along. Another one suggesting that, well, maybe it's not actually Khafre or Chephron after all. Maybe it's Khufu, the builder of the first pyramid, which may sound like a minor distinction, but within Egyptology, to even suggest that is a big deal to them. Another one suggesting, you know, maybe it was redone again in the Middle Kingdom. So at least they're starting to look at some of these things. Even begrudgingly, they don't want to, you know, talk about Shock or West.
Right.
So I think we're making headway, slowly.
Okay.
I'm not sure about surely, but slowly. And outside of Egyptology, you know, my geological colleagues, when I present at geological conferences, et cetera, they all agree with me. They have even said to me, they don't mean it snottily, but, you know, this is pretty simple geology. This is not really sophisticated stuff when it comes right down to it. More than one has said to me, well, where have the Egyptologists been all these years? Why didn't they see this themselves?
Let's talk really briefly about the Giza Plateau and what else have you found. Now, we know that the Sphinx Temple has these, I think they're like 20-ton blocks.
Oh, yeah. The Sphinx Temple is actually very important, and a lot of people don't recognize this. I know you do. The Sphinx Temple sits in front of the Sphinx, just east of the Sphinx, and it is built, it is built out of blocks, multi-ton blocks, 20, 30 tons or more, some of those blocks. They're huge limestone blocks, and they were quarried in the Sphinx enclosure, the area where the body of the Sphinx sits. The body of the Sphinx is below ground level on the Giza Plateau, so to carve the body, what they did is they carved out huge blocks, tens of tons each, and they moved them to the east, just in front of the current Sphinx, and built the Sphinx Temple. So the Sphinx Temple is actually as old as the core body, the oldest portion of the Sphinx. So you're talking about not just the Sphinx, but this huge multi-ton temple, which in my opinion now probably dates back to about 10,000 BC based on my most recent analysis, which, you know, again, throws the whole paradigm and changes the whole view of civilization and when civilization began, which is, again, why the Egyptologists are so resistant, because it really throws their paradigm into disarray.
Mm-hmm. Now, in that general area, have you discovered, or has anyone discovered, any structures that have similar weathering or megalithic blocks of that size, or any area in the plateau or any place else in Egypt?
Yes,
discovered.
Actually, Okay. When you go up the plateau, when I say go up, you're physically going up a little bit because of the incline. So if you walk mm-hmm. west toward the second pyramid, there's what's known as the mortuary temple. It's generally attributed to Khafre, the builder of the second pyramid, or Chephron, you can pronounce it that way. But this is made out of huge multi-ton limestone blocks also, and it has a similar weathering and similar style to the Sphinx Temple. And not just myself now, and not just John Anthony West, but several other geologists looking at this, even though a couple with Egyptological background, are coming to the conclusion that this is an older structure also. More or less, there was more than just a Sphinx in the Sphinx Temple initially on the Giza Plateau, you know, in pre-dynastic, prior to dynastic times. Mm-hmm. So it seems to have been more, you know, several structures on the Giza Plateau. Then it was taken over or reappropriated in dynastic times thousands of years later. And
okay,
you can see how these structures mm-hmm. have actually been reworked in dynastic times when you look at them closely.
So would you say that structure is close to or around about 10,000 BC, or is that would
yeah,
be
it's probably,
an estimated
it's
guess?
It's probably, in my estimation, intermediate in age, closer to the age of the Sphinx and Sphinx Temple, well mm-hmm. before dynastic times, but maybe a little bit younger than the Sphinx and Sphinx Temple, but at least 8,000, 7,000 BC, I would guesstimate.
Okay.
Maybe back to 10,000.
So that's pretty old.
Yeah, it was pretty old, no matter what. Even 5,000 BC, my initial very conservative date back 20-some years ago, was enough to blow the Egyptologists' minds, and they decided at that point, you know, they wanted to burn me at the stake, but that's hard in the 20th century back then. So instead they had this meeting where they were going to debate me and demolish me. Well, it didn't work out the way they thought.
Mm, interesting. I'm going to ask you one last question about some of these old buildings on the plateau. I don't think, just because there's so much weathering on these old structures, 10,000 years old, and limestone being such a soft rock anyhow.
Right, right.
No one's found any kind of hieroglyphs on any of these structures, have they?
Not the oldest structures. And this is interesting. And there's lots of weathering on the Giza Plateau, just to be clear for people who haven't been there. But what is important to me geologically is not how much weathering, but the nature of weathering, because we know fairly well the history of the Sahara Desert and the pre-Sahara Desert times. Sahara Desert's only about 5,000 years old, the current Sahara Desert, so it goes back to about 3,000 or a little more, 3,000 BC or a little earlier. But before that, it was a different climatic regime with much more rainfall, that type of thing. So what's really important to me as a geologist is not looking at just the degree of weathering, but the nature of it and tying that into ancient climates. So what you see on these structures that I'm talking about as being older is not just more weathering, but actually a different nature of weathering from a different climatic regime.
Okay. And to follow up on that thought, do you believe that there was a causeway of water that was in front of the Sphinx at one time? Some people
some people, I'm not sure if this is what you're addressing, but some people, this is a very old idea,
mm-hmm.
recently popularized, and I'll name names, but I don't mean to be bashing anyone, by Robert Temple, and he talks mm-hmm. about a moat and all this type of stuff causing weathering. I will say it, and I don't mean this in a nasty way, but I'll just be blunt because time is short. It is all nonsense geologically. Mm-hmm. The Sphinx could not hold the water. It's a karst topography. It's very porous. You would not be able to keep standing water for any length of time. And furthermore, the nature of the weathering that we see, it is indicative of water running down from the top, running over the plateau and going down the slopes. I've looked at this very, very carefully. If it were a moat or if it were water rising up from above, you would have diagnostic undercutting in these types of limestones, which you don't see at all. So, and he and other people have misinterpreted certain geological features that go back millions of years when these limestones were forming in an ancient ocean about 40 million years ago as being indicative of things that they're not indicative at all. So how do I want to say it? When you don't understand the geology, it's easy to see features and misinterpret them.
But isn't there a serious underground a group of canals and
they're not canals exactly. Yeah, they have water in them. You are, as I mentioned it, but people may not know what I'm referring to. It's a karst topography. People can think of, you know, maybe going into limestone caves and seeing the stalactites and stalagmites and all that type of thing. This is what you have under the Giza Plateau. Not so much stalactites and stalagmites, but you have a karst topography. You have a lot of natural caves, that type of thing, which over the millennia, over thousands of years, have been modified by humans, have been expanded. Something we found, when I say we, Thomas DeBecky and I, back in the early 1990s, was a chamber under the left paw of the Sphinx. We also found a tunnel-like feature along the body of the Sphinx. And these are probably artificial in the sense that they've been worked on by humans, but they may have started out as natural features. So, yes, it's a there's a lot of features like that. And actually, this gets back to the fact that if you tried to fill the Sphinx enclosure with water, it would leak like crazy. It would be like a sieve. It would actually drain into these underground features. You could not hold water in it competently unless you tiled the whole thing over, which would then mean you wouldn't have the weathering features that some people have been pointing out.
And that's because of the porous nature of limestone?
Yes, exactly, the porous nature of these limestones in particular. But limestone in general, So that's why I say you have to look at the whole picture geologically to understand the situation.
So what is your interest now that you've already revealed these this data on the Sphinx and the temple? Do you go there to conduct additional research, or you just go there?
I very much want to get into that chamber under the left paw that we found. Some people claim it's a hall of records that Edgar Cayce predicted. I'm not making that claim, but there's certainly something in it. And for decades now, I've been thwarted by people like Zahi Hawass, who was, you know, long in charge of the Giza Plateau. The official Egyptian in charge of it. Now that there's been a revolution and maybe a counter-revolution in Egypt, it's very hard to know what's going on politically, but I would like to get the funds and permission to go back and explore that in particular. I'd like to collect samples, which I've never been allowed to do some isotopic analysis. You know, again, a lot of it is not the science that's hindering it, but, or the techniques in science, but just gain permission to do things in Egypt. And, you know, in the meantime, I'm working on a number of other sites around the world that confirm that civilization goes back to the end of the last ice age.
Let's talk about this. Yeah, let's talk about another site that dates to 10,000 BC, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. So you have seen it, and what is your opinion?
I've been there. I'm sorry.
What is your opinion?
Oh well, I've been there a number of times now. Göbekli Tepe's in southeastern Turkey, just north of the Syrian border. It's being excavated very, very meticulously by Herr Professor Dr. Klaus Schmidt of the German Archaeological Institute. I've spoken with him on site about it. I was, like anyone, perhaps a bit skeptical about the dating initially, but I'm not anymore, having seen the site numerous times, having looked at all the technical reports, looked at, in this case, there are radiocarbon dates on some of the material associated with the site. The entire site was covered over artificially 8,000 BC, 10,000 years ago, and the oldest portions excavated so far date back to about 10,000 BC, so about 12,000 years ago. This is the end of the last ice age. It is a very sophisticated site. It consists of multiple stone circles, megalithic pillars arranged in circles, or what they call enclosures. So in that sense, it's sort of like Stonehenge, but there are about 20-some of these Stonehenge-type structures, most of which have yet to be excavated. They're only known geophysically. But unlike Stonehenge, these are limestone pillars, just like we have limestone in Egypt with the Sphinx and the Sphinx Temple, and they are absolutely beautifully carved. They're not rough-hewn like Stonehenge. They're beautifully carved. They have reliefs on them of animals, of what you can only call symbolic, language, but some kind of symbols on them, all kinds of different animals, from insects to birds to, you know, aurochs, ancient cow-type structure thing, foxes. There are carvings in the round. There's what they call the totem pole, beautifully carved stone work. And this all goes back to the 8,000 to 10,000 plus BC range. So this is not supposed to exist at such an early period. It indicates to me that we have, you know, genuine civilization. It goes back to the end of the last ice age, the oldest portions of it, and it's totally out of time according to standard chronologies. But it fits the time frame I've been talking about for over 20 years, pushing the Sphinx back. So to me, it's incredible confirmation that, yes, we have civilization going back to that early period, rather than civilization only going back to about 3,000 to 4,000 BC, which is what traditional Egyptologists and academics have been saying.
And does Schmidt have an idea of what the facility was used for? Was it a ceremonial center, a civic center, or
Is yes and no. What everyone is calling it, including Professor Schmidt, and I don't want to sound the wrong way, but everyone's saying, oh, it's a temple. It's the world's first temple. It's a temple. It's a temple. It's the oldest temple. And my reaction to that is, well, yeah, maybe it's a temple, but what do you do in archaeology when you don't know what something is? You call it a temple. When you find an object and you don't know what it's for, you say it's for religious purposes. I mean, it doesn't really say anything to me. I suspect that, well, not suspect, I believe we have good evidence, and this ties in with my colleague John Anthony West to a certain extent in Egypt, that when you go back to ancient times, they did not have the distinction between religion and science and, you know, intellectual activity that we do in the modern age. Even when you go back to medieval times, there's not that clear distinction. So yes, it may have been a temple in the general terms, but it was probably also a university, what we would call a university, a center of social, you know, gathering. I have found, and I described this in Forgotten Civilization, I have found correlations with celestial things in the sky, you know, so there's astronomical aspects to it. So it's, you know, it's a very sophisticated site, and I think it does it injustice to just say it's a temple.
Tell me, in the book you describe that the I'm going to call it a facility because it's probably that's a crude way of saying it, but that
It's a facility. It was probably multiple use.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'm not too far off. But you say that it was covered with stone approximately 8,000 years ago.
Correct.
So how did you discover that? Was it a testing of the stones, or was there organic material within that stone?
Okay. Both. It was covered over purposefully by 8,000 BC. Most archaeological sites are just left to, you know, they're abandoned. You know, people get up and move, or maybe there's a plague or a war, and everyone gets killed, and a few people survive, but eventually they die. And, you know, the site just gets left to the natural elements, and it fills in slowly. And that's not the case with Göbekli Tepe. It was purposefully covered over. You can see that geologically, that they were carting in buckets and baskets or whatever of material and spreading it out. They actually re-erected some pillars that were knocked down before they filled it in, as if to position them to record this is where it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it seems that what they were doing was trying to preserve it as best they could, maybe to come back to it and uncover it and get it started up again, or maybe for posterity. So you can see this geologically, that they were systematically filling it in. Schmidt agrees with this. He said it himself independently, and he's even made the comment that it's a different type of effort, but they spent as much effort covering it over as they did to build it, erect it in the first place. Now, how do you date this? Once it's covered over, there's still rainfall in this area. It's a fairly arid area now. There was more rainfall back at the end of the last ice age. There is organic material in the fill they used, so you can date that by radiocarbon. You can also do stratigraphy, the rock layers, and you can correlate that. And once it was all covered over, the water percolating down, we're talking limestone again, percolating down would dissolve some of the limestone, re-precipitate it. So if people think about going to a nice limestone cave where you see the stalactites and the stalagmites forming, those are datable because carbon exists in limestone. It's a calcium carbonate, and you can date those geological features. So you have that on a microscopic level with the fill of Göbekli Tepe, and therefore it can be dated as to when that fill was put into place and those micro stalactites and stalagmites started forming. So we have a very good set of data to indicate this was covered over purposefully 10,000 years ago by 8,000 BC.
And
so it preserved things beautifully.
And what would be the reason to cover
that? Well, that I think has to do with what I believe geologically was a huge catastrophe at the end of the last ice age. You mentioned it already. The subtitle of Forgotten Civilization, my latest book, is The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. End of the last ice age, was the ice age. It was cold, global temperatures. There were major ice sheets at higher latitudes, not where Göbekli Tepe is, not where Karu is, where the Sphinx is. But you were in an ice age. We were in an ice age. The planet was in an ice age. It came out of the ice age incredibly quickly, within just a couple of years, actually probably within months and weeks. There's this dramatic jump. We know that from very recent isotope data in the geological record that it happened virtually instantaneously from a geological perspective.
Okay.
Why? How does that happen? And what I've pieced together is that the driving factor was a major solar outburst. Major solar outbursts at the end of the last ice age, which would have caused cataclysmic changes on the surface of the Earth. It would have been very terrifying, and I think that this really hit the civilizations of the time and basically drove them into a dark age.
Well, let's talk about that since you brought it up. I have referenced Firestone West and Warwick Smith's book, The Cycles of Cosmic Catastrophes.
Right.
And in their book, they actually give it's actually a three-part cataclysm, starting 48,000 years ago, and then 28,000 years ago, and then 10,000 years ago, three-fifths. What is your feeling on
those dates need to be revised, and I'm not saying anything negative about them. And I'm only focusing right now in this discussion and my current research on the end of the last ice age. Now, what you have at the end of the last ice age, and this ties in with their work and things that they've been publishing and other people have been publishing, at the end of the last ice age, you actually have two events separated by about 1,200 years. End of the last ice age, geologically, the best date for it now is 9,700 BC. So we've been throwing around about 10,000 BC, but the end of the last ice age is almost precisely, and this is based on data within the last few years, almost precisely 9,700 BC, give or take a day or two. Not a day or two, a year or two, I'm trying to say. Give or take a year or two.
Yes.
But it's about 9,700 BC. That's when you have this dramatic warming. That's when I believe we have a major solar outburst, and there's isotope data to support that there was a major solar outburst then. It's primarily in sediment cores and ice cores from Greenland, and we have very good data on that. There is also, so that's a warming event, 9,700 BC. 10,900 BC, 1,200 years earlier, there is a dramatic cooling event. The ice age has sort of been ending. Things had been sort of warming up gradually, very gradually. All of a sudden, 10,900 BC, it snaps back into ultra-cold period. So that's 10,900 BC, stays very cold to 9,700 BC, then snaps back into warmer than it had been for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. So that's what's happening at the end of the last ice age. Some people will have heard the term Younger Dryas. That is the period from 10,900 BC to 9,700 BC. Okay, what's causing the Younger Dryas to begin and end? The beginning, 10,900 BC, there's lots of evidence for a comet either hitting the world, hitting Earth, or exploding in the atmosphere above Earth. A lot of people think that it was probably over northern Canada. Why a comet? Well, there's evidence for a comet in the sense of rare earths, heavy metals, isotopes, that type of thing. And also a comet would spread dust and debris in the atmosphere and would cause a cooling effect, we believe, as we see in the geological record. So it would cause the Earth to get very cold, but not end the ice age. It actually reinforces the ice age. So you've got that very dramatic event. Some people have considered that to be an event that caused some of the extinctions that we see at the end of the last ice age. Some people have tied it in with the extinction of the Clovis people in North America, for instance. Then, you know, it's very cold for 1,200 years. Then we have this dramatic warming event from a solar outburst, which, in my assessment, is what ends the early civilizations of the time, including the civilization associated with Göbekli Tepe, associated with the original Sphinx in Egypt, and essentially it drives people into a dark age, which lasts thousands of years before civilization reemerges about 500 BC.
Let me ask you really quickly, what is the terminating event that you feel? Is it the cold? Because Firestone talks about an irradiation of the Earth where people are actually irradiated.
Yeah,
from
but
this
see,
event.
You would get that. You get that in 9,700 BC. You get that with a major solar event, with the breakdown of the ionosphere. Paul LaViolette has the physicist who I know
right.
I mentioned him in the book talks about that too. Yeah, I mean, I think that there was a certain grappling, and you could get some of that with the cometary event, but I think most of that actually ties in with the 9,700 BC event. And again, I'm in no way putting down the other authors, but I think as we've gotten more information now, we can start to sort out these two events, which geologically, you know, 1,200 years is not much time. And that's part of the problem. In a lot of cases, data for them can be easily confused. Is this the 10,900 BC data or event or the 9,700 BC event? You know, in the many geological sections, there's not much separation between the two.
And both of them are not really friendly towards human beings. In other
words,
they make it uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's a very uncomfortable situation, and it both would have caused massive climate changes, devastation, that type of thing. But actually, the worst event, I think, from a human perspective, was the 9700 BC event with these major solar outbursts that would have entailed, you know, major radiation levels on the surface of the Earth. You would have broken down mm-hmm. the ionosphere. The ultraviolet light would be coming in as you destroy this ozone layer in the stratosphere. There's all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But something I want to point out is you would almost instantaneously melt miles worth of glaciers in high latitudes. This would release pressure, which would cause earthquake and volcanic activity to accelerate. Mm-hmm. We see this even on a small scale in Iceland to this day with the melting of the glaciers there. So it would have caused a cascading effect of earthquakes, volcanic activity, with all the melting of the ice, with melting of water from the oceans and lakes. In some cases, with a major solar outburst, you would have had essentially what would look like huge thunderbolts hitting the surface of the Earth, causing wildfires, causing incinerations. So it would have been incredibly dramatic. And you put a lot of moisture into the atmosphere. Well, what happens to that moisture? It has to come back out again. So you'd have torrential rains. This may, in fact, tie in with the Sphinx and the water erosion. And what we find worldwide, you know, the concept of, you know, some people will think of the biblical flood, but, you know, major flooding. And, of course, at the same time, sea levels are rising by 120 meters. Typically around the globe, flooding areas. So you've got floods on land, you've got floods in coastal areas, you have earthquake and volcanic activity, you have fires being set, you have earthquake activity. It was pretty rough.
It's a true catastrophe, basically, is what you're describing.
Yeah, a global catastrophe. And of course, the major climate change that...
Right.
is associated with it.
As a geologist, do you find any of the language by some people that there were tectonic plate shifts and huge landmass changes at this time?
That's a complicated question, but the short answer is not to the extent that some people are talking about. If you're talking about a major pole shift or a Hapgood type...
Hapgood type of
major pole shift at that time. No, I mean you've actually got enough with what I was describing, and I don't see evidence, for a major pole shift at that time. Yes, pole shifts have happened geologically, but I don't see that at 9700 BC. Not a major one. Yes, the pole probably shifted by a very small amount, and then you have to distinguish between the spin axis pole and the magnetic pole. You had a lot more change in the magnetic pole at that time just because of what was happening. Essentially, a solar outburst would cause geomagnetic storms. It would affect the magnetosphere of the Earth. That would let more radiation in from the external environment, you know, the cosmic environment. It was a lot of things were happening.
So it's enough, basically, to destroy a good portion of humanity on the Earth.
If it happened today, we'd be gone. Because, of course, it would destroy our modern electronics and communications, and the grids would go down, etc. I'm not saying they had all that back then, but it would have been devastating to any civilization, to any group of humans.
Okay, wow. Well, I'm glad that you have defined that. You actually have quite a bit to say in Forgotten Civilizations,
your latest book. People can read a lot more about this and the implications. And one of the things I think is very important, and I feel very strongly about this, is, well, it's interesting to study the past. It's just sort of interesting in its own right. But to me, there's a real story here. Because this can happen again. Anything like this geologically that has happened in the past is prone to happen again. And actually, all the indications are that our sun right now is going through another very erratic period, very variable behavior. People may have know that it's all predictions seem to be off with the sun. Well, this is exactly what happened at the end of the last ice age, based on isotope data of solar behavior, that it was very erratic. And I think there's a little warning here, a big warning here for us right now.
A number of native people, my interest, of course, is the Maya, have stated mm-hmm. that the Earth has gone through a number of cataclysms. Is there evidence for that at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because we're talking about the last one at the end of the last ice age, 9,700 BC, so let's say roughly 12,000 years ago. But, yeah, I think this is just part of a bigger cycle that it goes back further, on a crudely cyclical basis. Mm-hmm. Lots of people have talked about, cycles of gold, silver, bronze, iron age, or the Hindus, the Yuga cycle, the Mayans, and the cycles of the earth and the sun. And I don't think this is just willy-nilly. I don't think they just make this up. Or Plato with Atlantis, which dates back to 9700 BC by Plato's reckoning. Oh, I also wanted to mention, we find underground caves associated with 10,000 BC, end of last ice age. Well, why? Because that's how you would survive, by going underground.
That's true. That's interesting.
So there's a lot going on. And what kind of structures would survive? Big megalithic stone structures. Everything else would be gone. Mm, and that's exactly what we find. So I think it ties a lot of things together.
Mm. I want to remind our listeners that you can call in and speak with Dr. Robert Schock. The phone number to call is 347-826-9565. That's 347-826-9565. Robert, your book has a wonderful chapter in here. I'm going to read the first part of it. The chapter is called Defining Civilization. And the reason I found it quite unique is that you basically outline and reveal that our perceptions of ancient civilization and how they developed their culture is a little bit askewed, and this is what you write here. If we are to understand how the evidence of Göbekli Tepe, the redating of the Sphinx, and other developing data overturn and rewrite the old paradigms of how, when, and why sophisticated culture and civilization began, we need to examine the views, assumptions, and hypotheses that have prevailed among historians, prehistorians, and archaeologists for the last 80 years or so. When and where does civilization begin? How far back in time does high culture go? Indeed, we do mean by such terms civilization or sophisticated culture and high culture. Question. So in this chapter, you're basically tell us about this chapter, why you wrote that. I think it's basically that our views on prehistory are a little bit off. Is that correct?
Exactly. They're very much off, and it's been, and I'm an academic, so I grew up in the academic environment. I was taught this stuff as dogma, and sometimes you really have to look at the dogma and the preconceptions and what you were taught and what you and all your colleagues have assumed all this time. And one thing that I found is academics have assumed, they've made assumptions about what civilization is, how far back it can go, about to 3,500, 4,000 BC or so, and what the defining characteristics are, what they're going to look for if they don't find those characteristics, or if it's too old, more than about 5,000, 6,000 years old, it can't be civilization, or they just don't even look. When you're not looking for something, you don't find it. So that's a lot of it. They define, one way to define civilization classically is by literacy, that they have written language. Well, if all your records are destroyed, how do you know if there's a written language or not? As far as I'm concerned, it might well be that the Göbekli Tepe people had written language. And I'm not just saying that as a wild guess, but when we look at the pillars that have survived, there seems to be symbolic notation on those pillars. I don't think they were just carving what looked like H's and H's on their sides in the letter C and a reverse letter C, and specific animals and specific symbols that we can't interpret. I don't believe they were spending all the time and energy to carve those just because, you know, they thought they were decorative looking or it was essentially high-tech graffiti. You know, so I won't be surprised someday if we find the equivalent of a Dead Sea Scrolls for the Göbekli Tepe people, but, you know, 12,000 years old. And,
wow.
You know, we just have to I think part of my point in Forgotten Civilizations, we really have to look at our assumptions. You can't even deal with overturning your beliefs or moving forward with the data if you don't look at your own assumptions and your own biases and the blinders you put on yourself or have allowed other people to put on you.
Well, let's take a question here. This is from Sandy in Santa Fe. She asks, have you had any direct access to any of the inner chambers under the Sphinx? And she says that she read an article that Dr. Hawass actually has been under the Sphinx. Do you know anything about that?
Well, yeah, it depends on what you call under the Sphinx. He has been, and I've not been in it, but I've stuck my head into it. There is a chamber under the rump of the Sphinx. I have to orient myself. The left rump of the Sphinx, we found it seismically. I was not aware of it before we found it seismically. It turns out that Zai Hawass and the Antiquities Organization and other Egyptologists had been aware of it. So they confirmed that, yes, our data was good, and there was a chamber there. It's probably fairly young. When I say young, we're still talking thousands of years old, but not going back to that really remote period. So, yeah, that's known. That's been looked at. People have been in it. And as I said, I've stuck my head into it. But what we haven't been into, and I don't think anyone has been, at least there's no good evidence, there are all these rumors that maybe people tried to get into it, but I don't see how because there's no clear entrance to it. The chamber under the left paw that we found, the tunnel-type network that runs along the body of the Sphinx. To my knowledge, no one has ever entered those. In fact, they may be flooded right now by rising water tables from the modern city of Giza in Greater Cairo. And
okay.
The entrance to them, I suspect, is under a cliff east of the Sphinx, which is now buried in 15 or more meters of sand.
Hawass is quite a character.
He's
kind of a showman. I've heard him speak here in the States, and I don't know. He kind of holds up the banner of Egyptology, but I think there's a little bit of showmanship involved in that.
There's a lot of showmanship and a lot of I don't know what the good term is right now. But. You know,
he
is what he is, and I mean, I know him, and I've had many private meetings and dinners and lunches with him, and so we know each other. But yeah, he's quite a character, put it that way.
Okay, here's a question from Facebook. This is Bob emailing from Los Angeles. How old are the? I think he says sculptures on Easter Island.
That's something we didn't get into in this conversation, but I do, as you know, talk about in Forgotten Civilization. The answer to the question is I'm not sure how old they are, but I believe they go back much earlier. At least some of them go back much earlier, because this was probably a long tradition of carving things on Easter Island, and there was, you know, an indigenous culture to Easter Island until it was discovered, or rediscovered, I should say, by the Dutch in 1722. I hate to say discovered, because we're talking about the European discovery, but the oldest moai, the big heads and torsos on Easter Island, I believe are thousands and thousands of years earlier than the standard conventional attribution of, you know, maybe 1,500 years old. The conventional archaeologists and prehistorians date Easter Island to a very, very late period. And based on preliminary geological analysis that I've done. Katie and I, Katie's my wife, have been to Easter Island a couple of times. And I think that there's a big area for study there. I think that when all is said and done, we're going to find that Easter Island goes back to a very early period, maybe probably the end of the last ice age. There are basalt moai there, for instance, that we don't know the quarries that they came from. In my opinion, the quarries are probably going to be found under the current sea level. That means they were being worked before the sea levels rose, which would then put us back at the end of the last ice age. So, I mean, we could be talking immense antiquity for Easter Island, just as we are now talking about immense antiquity for the original Sphinx and Sphinx Temple, mm-hmm. as we're talking about for Göbekli Tepe in southeastern Turkey and, various other sites around the world.
That's fascinating. Well, my guest has been Robert Schock. His book, Forgotten Civilizations, The Role of Solar Outbursts in Our Past and Future. Robert, it's been a pleasure. Can you tell us about anything that's coming up for you? Are you going to be speaking?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, Forgotten Civilization. I hope everyone mm-hmm. will read that, not because I'm trying to sell the book, because I think the information is important. And people should go to my website, www.robertschock, and I want to spell the last name in case people don't know it. My last name is spelled S-C-H-O-C-H. S-C-H-O-C-H. So it's www.robertschock.com. That's my mm-hmm. website. And I will be speaking next month in May in Baltimore at the Fortean meeting. That's actually not, I don't have a link up to that right now, but if people Google that, they can find 14 meeting. If they go to my website, they'll see that I will be speaking in upstate New York at the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. Some people know the artist Alex Gray. That is his foundation or institute, Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. I'll be speaking there for a full moon. I forget what he calls it, full moon festival, something like that. Should be very nice. So I encourage people to come to that. I'll be speaking in Arizona later in the summer. So, and I'll be speaking in South Africa if there's South African listeners and Italy. So people should go to my website, or if they go to my website, they can also they'll see Katie's email down at the bottom. Katie is my wife and can always contact me through her.
Fantastic. Now, is there going to be a follow-up to Mystery of the Sphinx at all? Any kind of, that was a while ago. I'm just wondering.
I'm hoping this is something that John Anthony West and I are working on right now. In fact, if someone's mm-hmm. listening who is a major producer or director, that type of thing, please contact me. Yes, because this is something we're looking into. Very much so, and we have some interest and whatnot, and I won't say more about that. But yes.
Okay, fantastic.
It should be happening.
Robert, it's been a pleasure. These things are costly.
Yeah.
Yes, I can imagine. Yes, it's been a real pleasure having you on the program, and please listen to this tape, and it'll be available. Now it's available on iTunes, so you're welcome to go to iTunes and download it. Thank you, and we will talk to you again next year. Bye-bye.
Sounds good.
Many archaeologists and Egyptologists